From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. And this is a show where we deal every week with mental health issues from a holistic perspective. And basically, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Now, this is a live call-in show, so if you're in the Phoenix area and want to participate, if you have a question or a comment about today's topic, the phone number is area code 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And if you're listening via the internet, as I know there are people out there, because I get emails from some of you, the number is the same. It's a toll number for you guys. It's 480-949-1310. Now, today we're going to be talking about a topic that, even in doing my research, I found myself brought to tears a number of times. So if I make it through today's show without breaking down myself, it'll be amazing. We're going to be talking about the issue of organ donors. And I actually will have a couple of guests on in a little bit. If you've listened to this show before, you've known that I've been very involved with AIDS work since the mid-80s. And during the 80s and most of the 90s, death was really an intense part of my life. Being an HIV-negative gay man and a caregiver and a therapist, I've been at bedsides of literally hundreds of friends, colleagues, clients over those years, and the grief was intense. The grief was constant. And it became infused as part of my life and the life of so many others all around the world during that period and still, especially if you look at Africa today where they don't have the meds really to treat the symptoms of HIV. That's when you're infused with constant illness and death. But something else goes on also as I've been doing research for today's show. Most of the time, when people are dealing with death, it's a sudden thing. It's unexpected. And I know that even with a lot of people I knew with AIDS, they weren't prepared. They hadn't done do not resuscitate orders. They hadn't done wills. They hadn't thought through what to do for a memorial and what to do with their bodies after they've died, because most people don't want to think about those things. Most people don't want to plan ahead. Literally, I've had people say to me, well, if I think about it, I'll invite it. You know, that consciousness about, you know, if I talk about something, it'll happen. Well, I do believe that thought is creative, but I also believe that if we face these issues, that the more we face our fear of death, the more alive and the more present in our life we can be. And yet, my first guest today was thrust into a situation because of an accident that occurred to a loved one and had to make decisions in the moment of grief. And that's a very difficult thing to do. So in dealing with organ donors, let's start with facts and statistics, because I really want to get this out of the way. Many of you who are listening out there right now, you know, may be thinking about turning the dial because this is too intense a topic for a Saturday afternoon. Well, I invite you to stay with this because it may allow you to release even some old grief of your own, or awaken your mind to doing something that truly can be a gift for somebody else. So, from the United Network for Organ Sharing, from their website, which is UNOS.org, as of today, current statistics, there are 85,426 individuals who are candidates on the waiting list for an organ transplant. 85,426 in this country. Transplants, as of February 2004, very current, and these statistics were put up there on May 14th, there were 4,285 organ transplants in this country in January and February. There were 2,221 donors in January and February of this year. More than 80,000 men, women, and children currently await life-saving transplants. Every 13 minutes, another name is added to the national transplant waiting list. Every 13 minutes. And some of you listening may be on that list yourself, or may soon be. An average of 17 people die each day from the lack of available organs for transplant. An average of 17 people die each day because there's not available organs for them. And those are just some of the statistics that we're dealing with. Large numbers. But those numbers are even more imposing if you're one of those people waiting for a transplant. Now, my first guest today is a woman who just wrote a book about her relationship with her daughter and this and the grieving that she went through and the decision-making process she went through and how all of this was handled. And the book, from what I've read so far, is very touching and very real and very genuine. And my guest's name is Eleanor Vincent, and the name of her book is Swimming with Maya, Maya being the name of her daughter. And before I even talk to Eleanor, I want to read you a short section of the first chapter. The day went quickly, and the traffic gods were with me. Before I knew it, I was back home, and it was only 5:30, plenty of time to make a salad and go with the pizza. As I walked from the car, I began to sing, reviewing our plans for the evening. When I opened the gate, still humming, I found the front door ajar. My younger daughter confronted me. Her face was drawn and pale. "Mom, you have to call the hospital. Something terrible has happened to Maya." Instantly, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. Gears ground in my head. My first thought was, no, this is not true, but already I was trembling. I stared at 11-year-old Megan. With reddish-brown hair and a sturdy frame, she was the opposite of her willowy sister. As I looked at her, she seemed tiny, as if she had physically shrunken. Her voice sounded far away, like a NASA astronaut speaking to a distant command center. She backed away from the door as I came in and set my briefcase on a chair. Since I had no cell phone, I now realized that this little sixth grader had been alone with this horrible news for the last hour. When my feet stayed glued to their spot, Megan urged me on. A nurse phoned, "You have to call the hospital right away." In slow motion, I turned towards the dining room table. My arms felt heavy, as if lifting the phone from its cradle would be too great an effort. "Mom," Megan said with blatant impatience, "please, you have to call now." I knew I should move faster, yet I could not break out of my zombie pace. I removed a notebook from my briefcase and dialed the number Megan had scribbled on a scrap of paper. I cradled the phone with my left shoulder, a habit of a former news reporter, and took notes with my other hand. "Trauma unit," a businesslike voice said, "Nurse Harris speaking." As soon as I inquired about Meyer, her voice softened. "At about 3:45 this afternoon, your daughter was in an accident. She has a subdural hematoma, a blood clot in her brain, and is undergoing brain surgery right now. Please come to the emergency room as soon as you can." This is something I think every parent dreads to hear. This is something that every parent, I know that my 17-year-old nephew recently got his driver's license, and within a few months, a friend of his parents got that same call. A 17-year-old friend of his was driving in a car, had a car accident, and was killed. This is why we need to deal with issues. This is why we need to deal with our fears. So I want to introduce all of you now to Eleanor Vincent, who is the author of Swimming with Maya and one of those parents that faced the unfaceable. Eleanor, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Stuart.
I have to say, even reading that earlier today, it brought tears to my eyes. And I cannot imagine what it must have been like in that moment and what it must have been like for your younger daughter also, who seemed to really rise to the occasion and became the adult in that moment.
Yeah.
What can you tell us a little bit more about that initial experience? And at a certain point, I really want to hear from you how it was presented to you about the idea of donating Maya's organs.
Well, that came 4 days later. In the moment, in the place where you read from the book from chapter one, was the very first moment when, as you say, I got the news that no parent ever wants to get, and I think that we all fear. And, of course, I couldn't fully take it in. And you're entirely correct. Megan did rise to the occasion. She was completely amazing. And she had had an hour or so to process this information. She knew on some level, much deeper than I did at that point, that it was real and that I needed to take action. But in just hearing the news, I literally became frozen. It's as if, like, you poured molasses into a set of gears. Everything in my body and my mind completely slowed down. And I think that is the psyche's way of protecting itself from just a terribly, terribly dreadful circumstance. So even though I knew that I needed to call the hospital, I somehow couldn't move in that direction. And it was only Megan's presence that made me realize I need to do this. And, you know, fortunately for us, Megan had some very close friends, and the mother in that family was a nurse. And so she immediately came, and as I was leaving the house, she came to assist and take care of Megan.
But the thing that amazed me even in that first chapter was how Megan had the wherewithal to make that phone call, to take care of you enough to know that once you got home,
right,
she was being taken care of and you didn't have to worry about it. I really give her kudos for stepping up like that.
Yes. Well, Megan has always been a pretty amazing person. And through this entire circumstance and the aftermath, I think she has been more resilient, stronger, more present and able to process things than I ever could have hoped. I give her many kudos also.
Yeah.
She's an amazing individual. And like many children of single mothers, she knew what to do. We always had backup plans in place. You know, we relied heavily on friends and other parents to help out and always tried to return the favor. But Megan knew that she would be safe with the Coxes and that that was the best thing for her to do. So I'm really grateful to that family for the way they stepped in, and not only that day, but in the aftermath, because Megan and her friend Laura are still good friends today, even though it's 12 years have passed. And Laura and some of Megan's other friends in her elementary school absolutely stepped in after this happened and just surrounded Megan with love, with friendship, with loyalty. And I know that, you know, as well as everything that I and her father tried to do for Megan, that helped her tremendously. That kind of support was so important for her.
It's amazing what comes forth from the innocence of youth.
Yes.
Yes. So let's move the story along a little bit. I know that once you got to the hospital, you were still in a daze, and some of Maya's friends were already waiting there, and you were told what had happened.
Yes.
At one point, I know that Maya was already in a coma, and your grieving and your fears were certainly up. What happened at that point, and at what point did the concept of organ donors come in?
Well, Maya was actually killed by a fall and a head injury from a horse. And the whole circumstance was so improbable that it took me most of the 4 days that she was in the coma in the hospital to try to come to grips with what had actually happened. So she went into a coma instantly as soon as she hit the ground. It was a catastrophic fall directly onto her head. And so the entire time that I was with my daughter in the hospital, she was never conscious. She was profoundly unconscious. After her brain surgery, they put her into a deeper coma to try to be sure that there would be no brainwave activity so that they could attempt to bring down the swelling in the brain. And despite heroic measures, life support, all kinds of medications, they were not able to save her. So when her surgeon told me that she was brain dead, he asked if I would consider organ donation. And something inside me told me that that was the right thing to do, and I said yes.
Immediately?
Yes. Immediately.
Uh-huh.
Now, I should say that I had had some previous experience along these lines. My mother had died a year and a half previously of end-stage diabetes and kidney failure. And a kidney transplant would have saved my mother's life. I was very aware that making the decision to donate could potentially protect another family from what we had already been through with my mom and what I was now going through with my daughter. And so in that moment, my thoughts were of some other family in some other hospital under intense stress, praying and hoping that someone would say yes. And I could clearly picture in my mind that family and that situation because I was on the opposite end of that situation at that moment. And I knew that I would do anything to help some other family not feel the kind of devastation that we felt at that moment.
Did you have a sense that Maya would have made the same decision if she was able?
You know, honestly,
is that who Maya was?
Honestly, Stuart, I really don't know. I think she would have.
Okay.
And when I discussed with her my wishes and told her that because of my experience with my mom, I was putting the pink sticker on the back of my driver's license, she absolutely supported the decision. She thought it was the right thing to do. But she never said to me, you know, Mom, if anything were to happen to me, I want to become an organ donor.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know what her wishes would have been. But I do know that Maya was a very generous, very giving, very outgoing person. And now through having met two of the recipients of her organs, I know that she is so proud that she was able in some way to play a part in their lives and that she continues on physically in their lives to this day. So that I do know, but I cannot say for certain what her wishes would have been.
Mm-hmm. What kind of challenges were you facing? Obviously, there was an intuitive knowingness that you had about just saying yes when that question was asked. Were there difficulties in this process? What were the challenges? And what exactly is the procedural stuff that you went through to facilitate the donations?
Mm-hmm. Well, in Swimming with Maya, I go into this in great detail, but let me be brief and just say there is a process in place. A donor coordinator came to the hospital. We signed consent forms. She explained the process to me, assured me that Maya's body would be treated with great respect, that if we so chose, we could still have an open casket funeral. That was not my choice, but I could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were very professional about the entire way that it was conducted. Of course, later, months later, years later, I had many, many questions about what had actually happened to my daughter's body in the course of the recovery surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked those questions and I did a considerable amount of research into what is actually involved in a transplantation operation. How does it work? How do the organs get transported? What happens on the recipient end of things? I really very much needed and wanted to know that. And I think I must have called my donor coordinator dozens of times saying to her, please explain about brain death to me again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, brain death is not an easy concept. What I now understand after 12 years and a lot of study on this and a lot of reflection is nothing could have brought Maya back. Literally, her brain had stopped functioning. It was oxygen starved. No blood was going into her brain tissue. she was gone in that sense. There was no way that she could ever have been resuscitated. Given that, I know that the decision I made was the correct decision. Just looking into the faces of the people who received her organs, both her heart recipient and her liver recipient, who actually lives there in the valley in Mesa and is just a wonderful woman, I know that this was the right decision. And then in some fundamental way, it was right for Maya as well. It was right for her life energy to continue on in this form. I can't tell you how I know that. I just know it.
Well, I believe that. I believe that we do have an innate, intuitive connection to feelings and beliefs and guidance like that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what I'm hearing you describe is what I know to be an extended part of the grieving process. Like you said, even a couple of years later, you're still asking questions. You're still needing to finalize and crystallize what had actually happened,
mm-hmm.
and to get a sense of clarity in order to finally let go.
Exactly.
And a couple of weeks ago, I did a show on grief, and it's very clear for those that are listening who are impatient with loved ones still grieving about it, that everybody takes their own time and does it in their own way. There's no quick fix to grieve. And sometimes years later, something else triggers it and brings up more. And I think what you were doing was really honoring your own journey and your own grieving process.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in some ways, I felt cursed, but I also felt blessed that my mother had died before my daughter, because
mm-hmm.
I already had a great deal of knowledge about what my own process was, about what I needed to do for myself, about how I needed to reach out. And I actually have come to believe that this idea of closure is a dangerous myth,
mm-hmm.
and that we would all be much better off if we could let go of the idea of time frames, the idea that we were ever going to completely resolve this,
right.
and just accept it as the great mystery of life
mm-hmm.
that it is, and learn to incorporate lost loved ones into our lives now, today, in a very deep way. That, to me, is the healing.
I totally agree with you. It's why I said in my introduction, as I was reading your story and the story of a donor who may be calling in a little bit, my grieving came up again. I mean, I actually was crying in preparing for today's show, and I realized what was going through my head were the faces and the hearts of friends that had passed away 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
And I hope that I'm always that moved and that alive to feel that grief for the rest of my life, because
mm-hmm.
it's part of, they are a part of who I am. Those experiences are part of how I became who I am today,
mm-hmm.
and it needs to be honored.
Absolutely.
And I get the feeling that even writing this book, Swimming with Maya, was part of that process for you, and a great gift you're giving other people who, you know, hopefully I will encourage to read it, even though it's not necessarily, like I said, people tend to want to avoid dealing with issues like this, but from the sensitivity of that first chapter, I'm quite moved with the gift you're giving the readers.
Well, thank you, and the kind of feedback I'm getting now through emails and through meeting people as I go out to read from the book and talk is that the book is fundamentally giving them a new window into their own lives. People have told me that it's changed the way that they relate to their children, that it's made them more aware of the preciousness of life, that it's actually made them more joyful. I think we tend to think of this as, oh, it's such a sad thing, it's so tragic, and that is true. It is tragic. But out of it came so many wonderful things, and I think the book is a testament to the resilience of the human spirit. I mean, at the beginning you were talking about Megan. Well, there's a study in resilience. And, you know, I feel that I have worked very hard to encourage and support not only Megan's resilience, but my own. And that doesn't mean that we need to be strong in the face of grief, another dangerous myth in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Grieving means being open to the feelings in the moment, and
totally
those feelings
agree.
Can vary widely. So I could swing in any given moment from rage and anger and disbelief to just intense, intense sorrow. And I try to portray that process very, very honestly in the book. But I also portray the recovery, which is what comes out of going as deep as we can into the feelings in the moment through some mysterious process. That is what heals us. And when we block ourselves from experiencing the feelings, what we're doing is actually blocking the healing. So, you know, I learned to trust the grief process, to trust and know that no matter how deep I went, I would surface miraculously and be in a different place after that.
I think so, what a lot of people miss out on also is mixed in with all of those feelings that you mentioned, that even in that process, there are periods of joy and a heart opening and inner peace and a connection of love with the individual, with life that you're still in and stuff. And sometimes people feel guilty when those waves come and mm-hmm. they're thinking something's wrong with them. How can I be feeling so amazing in this time when I've just lost someone I love?
Right.
And the wave of emotions equates our humanity, you know, the range of those emotions, and to embrace even the joy even that comes even in the time of grief at times.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think people might have thought I was crazy at the time, and I probably was a bit. But, you know, I would have these memories of Maya, of something funny she had said or done, or, you know, some happy memory, and I would, you know, start talking about it and laughing about it and sharing it. I'm sure people thought I was completely mad.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of course, those moments of joy, everything, it becomes absolutely crystalline when you start moving through this process. And I can remember for the first few weeks after she died, I was very aware of the state that I was in, that I was walking around basically in a state of grace, that I had never felt so connected to plants, to animals, to people, to life, to whatever we believe about what the afterlife is like. And I realized that afterlife is so close to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some faraway place. The loved one is just right across this veil that is so thin. And I, you know, I couldn't see her or touch her, but I could feel her. And she would be with me at times, and it was just overwhelming. My whole body would tingle. I would feel warm. I could tell that she was with me and that she was trying to make contact with me.
Mm-hmm.
And through that and through dreams and through some of Megan's amazing dreams, which I report in the book, I was able to have contact with my daughter, to know that even though she was out of my physical sight and reach, that she was very much alive, that her life was continuing in some fundamental way. So I think that was extremely comforting to me.
Well, I totally relate to it because, like I said, during all those years of dealing with HIV and AIDS and the deaths and stuff, I've had many connections like that, and it really transformed me and my whole approach to life and my belief system.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a short break here. This is Stuart Altschuler. You're listening to Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, and my guest, Eleanor Vincent. And we will be back in just a couple of minutes, so stay tuned, and we'll have more of Tell the Truth Faster. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altschuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues. And today's story and today's topic is on organ donors. And there's nothing more relevant to mental health issues than the grieving process and the transformation that occurs, but also the stories of inspiration and impact that people have when they make a choice to donate their own organs or the loved one's organs upon death, and the impact it has on the recipients and the recipients' families as well as the donors' families. And we've been talking with Eleanor Vincent, who's the author of Swimming with Maya, which is really the story of her relationship with her daughter who died a number of years ago, and Eleanor being faced with the decision to donate Maya's organs, and even talked for a moment about meeting some of the recipients of Maya's organs and the impact it had on her to know that her daughter actually lives on through the lives of these people. We have with us today also the benefit and the intense power of a recipient of a heart. And his name is Stephen Taibbi, and he's from the East Coast. And in July of 2000, he was informed he had developed idiopathic cardiomyopathy, which means a virus had settled in his heart and was killing it. And after a 10-and-a-half-month wait, he received the gift of life on March 27, 2001. And today he's an avid advocate for the cause of organ donation. Steve, I really want to welcome you to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Again, you heard Eleanor's story of what it was like to make that decision, and she alluded to the power of meeting the recipients and the effect it had on these families. Can you talk a little bit about your own journey and what it was like waiting those 10-and-a-half months and what it's like having another person's heart beating inside of you, keeping you alive now?
Well, that's a lot of stuff in a short time, but the wait was much harder on, I believe, my wife than it was on myself, because I've always been comfortable with the idea of my death. To me, death is like nighttime; it's coming, so it's just a thing that's part of life. It's that simple for me. But it was watching my wife during those 10-and-a-half months watch me deteriorate. That was the most difficult thing of all. But it wasn't the fact that I may or may not survive until there was a donor. I just want to say, though, that in that waiting time, I would think about my donor, and I would think about how it would have to be somebody who had no idea that they were about to die, because it's always a trauma. And I used to say, if I could only go back in time and stop that person from doing what they would do, I would do it. Most of us have some survivor's guilt about that, and I just always feel that was an amazing gift. I mean, there you are, you're waiting. But by the time I got my heart, my wife and I both thought I might have had 1 or 2 weeks left. And you're literally standing at the edge of the abyss, and perfect strangers, people you have no knowledge of whatsoever, reach out across and pull you back. And there's just no way to say thank you enough for something like that. That's why I am such an avid advocate, because it's just one of the things that I do to honor my my donor and his family. I pray for them daily. When we have a holiday, we set a place for him. I know it's a him, but I've never met my donor or his family. They did not answer my letter, which is, that's okay too, because that's how they need to do it. But there's just no way to say thank you enough to something like that. And I always call my chest now my treasure chest, because that's where I keep his heart. And it's not my heart, it's his heart, and he's letting me borrow it for a while. And the only thing I hope is that his family understands that while he's keeping me alive, I'm helping keep him alive too.
That's amazing. You also, not only did you get your life back, but you also then, as a way of honoring this and carrying it forward, in a sense, have dedicated your life to organ donor issues with Transplant Speakers International. Am I right about that?
Yes, I'm a member of the board of Transplant Speakers International, Inc. We are a nonprofit, all volunteer organization. We're made up of donors and recipients. It was started by a gentleman named Pete Radigan, who was waiting for his heart at the time at Columbia Presbyterian in New York. That's where I had my transplant as well. And it's grown into an organization where what we do is we go around to the various OPOs, which means organ procurement organizations. Every state has those. That's where you get listed at the state level. And we go around to the various OPOs. I'm at one right now, as a matter of fact, and we train them. We train their volunteers how to be speakers, but how to be effective speakers, so that we can get the word out more. There are 59 OPOs in the country, and we service 56 of them.
And you actually do training, but you also go out there and speak to groups when necessary to yourself still?
I speak as often as I can, whether it's on my own, whether it's with my local OPO, or whether it's with Transplant Speakers International. And actually, we have created a new e-learning system that we're trying to make a standard curriculum that could be available in high schools. And the state of Arkansas has already accepted our e-learning program as what they're going to teach high schoolers.
Now, Eleanor, to bring you back into this also, I know that you do a lot of public speaking, too, not just relevant to your book, but also relevant to what Stephen's doing. Am I right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's been a great joy to do that and to meet all kinds of people within the transplantation community. And I just wanted to commend Steve not only for the work he's doing, but for the amazing consciousness that he has about the gift that he received. And what I'm hearing you say, Steve, is something that's very precious to me, and that is the underlying kinship between donors and recipients. It's an interesting and new kind of relationship that develops, I think. It's not quite family, but it's certainly more than being someone's friend, and I think of us as a kind of kin.
Yes,
even though it's not the person that your daughter's organs went
absolutely.
To, there's that community consciousness, you're saying.
Absolutely, and the kind
yep.
of sharing and the kind of honoring and the kind of respect that Steve is talking about, I cannot even tell you, as a donor mother, what that means to me. And I have to say that from meeting recipients over the years who had absolutely nothing to do with our case, I have found that to be the norm, that people are so grateful, they almost can't put into words how grateful they are, and they want to come and meet anyone who is a donor, even though it's not their own donor, and they want to talk to you, they want to find out your story, they want to know how you feel, and, you know, because, as Steve pointed out, some people are not able to respond when contacted by a recipient. And, of course, these contacts are always anonymous, at least until both people give their consent if they want to be more personal. And I've had many recipients ask me, well, how did you feel when you got the letter from the recipient, or what caused you to respond? Because they may not hear from their donor family. And I always tell them, please know that that donor family is so uplifted by you, even if they choose not to respond to you. It may be that their grief is so overwhelming, or they just don't know exactly what to say.
Right.
But never think that not getting a response doesn't mean that those people don't think about you every day and the fact that their loved one's heart is beating in your chest. So I think that kind of dialogue between donors and recipients, understanding the whole spectrum of the experience, is so important. And so I'm just so pleased to hear about the work that Steve and the others in this Transplant Speakers International are doing. I think it's tremendous.
Well, we always believe, and I certainly, but I know all of us believe, that this is not about the recipient. This is all about the donor.
Uh-huh.
And on the days, like I just had my third anniversary a month ago, and that day was not a day of celebration for me, but rather it was a day of prayer and thought for the donor family.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way I feel. And we at Transplant Speakers International, all of us who are recipients who go around speaking, trying to raise awareness, I think in the bottom of our hearts, if I may use that word, or the bottom of our shared hearts, what we're really trying to do is put ourselves out of business, because it would be great if there was no need, if the waiting list could be decimated and there were enough people who had become, who had signed up to become donors, that that there would be this, that we could end this needless death of 17 people a day.
Yes.
What, and either one of you can answer this, what are usually the thoughts or the justifications that people will use when they're faced with the decision and decide not to donate organs of their dying loved one? What are usually the rationales for that that you hear?
Well, I think sometimes it's religious in nature. And sometimes I think it's just fear. They're afraid that their loved one's body is going to be desecrated in some way. sometimes I think it's that people are in such a state of shock, and they may not have been approached correctly or in a sensitive manner, and they may just think, well, how can you be asking me this now? And they just shut down and say no. So I think there are many, many reasons why, and I've probably just scratched the surface of, you know, what the reasons may be. It is such an individual decision. There can be no more painful decision than this one. And I think I have learned over the years to just respect people who have different views about this, including people in my own family. Not everyone feels the same way about this as Steve and I and others do in the community. I mean, to us, it seems very obvious that this is the right thing to do. But some people don't feel that way about it.
Which is why it's important that these things be discussed within families. In other words, death needs to be a topic, and it's one of the topics in this country that's not discussed, even though in other countries, even in Europe and other countries, where it's part of what's discussed and taught to people. But in this country, it's one of the taboo subjects. Mm-hmm. And all the more reason that these decisions are not facing people in their moment of grief, but is something that's been decided well in advance, you know, like you had told your daughter, Maya, you know, this is what I want to have happen.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, I always encourage families, talk to your loved ones, have the conversation, as difficult as it may be, talk about what your wishes are, not only about the disposition of your organs, and by the way, your tissue and bone. I donated everything that I could of my daughter, and her tissue and bone went on to help more than 50 people. Now, that was something I didn't truly understand in the moment, how many people would be helped by that. But, you know, there are many ways to donate. People routinely donate blood. This is just another step on the continuum, and there's so much that can benefit others, that can relieve suffering, that can, you know, change the lives of people who have had disfiguring injuries or burns. So there is very, very much to be gained by deciding to do this, and we are in charge of this. We have the power to make the decision. You can say, donate my bone, but not my skin. Donate my solid organs, but not anything else. I mean, but you must absolutely have this discussion with your loved ones and talk about what your wishes are, because even if you make the decision and put the pink sticker on your license, they can overrule your decision at that final moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it is just so important to have this conversation.
I think also just to answer the issue of the religious fears, that major religions support donor organ donation. In fact, the Rabbinical Council of America has approved organ donation, and Pope John Paul II referred to organ donation as an act of love.
Oh, absolutely.
Can I interject here?
Yes, please.
There is not one religion in America that forbids donation. Some of them will say it's up to you, but you name me the religion, and their official position is at the very least it's up to you or yes. The only two, it's really pretty much almost cultures, that don't allow donation are Shinto and Gypsies, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So whatever religion you are, if you're not a Shinto and you're not a Gypsy, it's all right for you to donate, no matter what you may have thought before that.
Also, I want to talk actually a little bit about how people can access additional information. So I'm going to give both of you a chance kind of in closing before I do my own closing. I know, Eleanor, that you're doing a book tour about Swimming with Maya, but you also have a website, www.swimmingwithmaya.com. And I'm assuming that that's one place people can get more information about your story, buying the book, finding out where you're going to be appearing, as well as contacting you. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And in addition, I have a page on my website that lists resources both for grief and bereavement recovery, and also for donation and transplantation. And there are a number of wonderful websites out there.
Wonderful. And I know actually when checking that, that there were a tremendous number of resources everywhere from government to non-governmental nonprofit organizations. And what are your book signing experiences like? I mean, do you, a lot of people showing up, are they Do they tend to be people who have already experienced this on one end or the other, or is it also, because I know your book is really about the story of your relationship with your daughter, along with what happened with her death.
What kind of feedback spectrum, actually. Whenever I do an event that is specifically themed around donation, as I recently did in Phoenix, along with our liver recipient, Patty Frame, her beautiful daughter, Erin, my daughter, Megan, and I, together did an event at the Scottsdale Public Library over the Mother's Day weekend. And for that event, I think most of the attendees had some relationship to transplantation. Either they were donor families, or they were recipients, or they were waiting, or they were working in the field. But when I just do readings in bookstores, typically that is a much broader cross-section of people, and they come for many different reasons. Some come because they've had some experience with child loss. Some come because they just think it's a compelling story and they want to know more. Some come probably just out of curiosity. And, you know, for whatever reason they come, I'm always grateful to welcome them there and to share the story with them. And I try to give them the full spectrum of the story from the very beginning, Stuart, from the part where you read from, all the way to the end when I'm sending Megan away to college and what that was like for Megan and for me, so that they get the full spectrum of the recovery and they see that I'm a living example that even the most dire tragedy can be resolved. It takes time, it takes work, but I'm really all about giving a message of hope and inspiration to people. So I very much enjoy that process, and I'm getting tremendous feedback from people about it, and it just really makes this whole effort so worthwhile to me.
Well, I just in speaking with you now and reading what I've read from you, I can totally believe that, no pun intended, your heart's in the right place with this, and that it's feeding you as much as you're feeding other people in this process.
Oh, absolutely.
Steve, how about you? I know that Transplant Speakers International has a website. You want to talk a little bit about that and how people might reach you?
Sure. Transplant Speakers International website is www.transplant-speakers.org. And I can be reached through that website. There's a place that where you can just through the website contact us, and I can be reached that way. Or I could be reached at well, that's actually the better way to reach me. But that website has a tremendous amount of information. We have two sites that teach, and we update it, and it's just a very good resource. It's one of the resources that are available.
Is there anything else the two of you want to say to one another at this point? I know that this we talked about synchronicity without using that word. I mean the timing of events, the opportunistic positive things that occurred in the course of grieving and letting go and healing and things like that. Even the show today was that, because as soon as I sent out the announcement about having Eleanor on as a guest, my own brother emailed me and said, you need to call my friend Steve Taibbi because he's been a heart recipient, and that just happened yesterday. So the unfolding of this balance on the show to me is even part of the energy that I think envelops all of us, that brings together the right people at the right time. Is there anything else that either one of you want to share with one another or with the listeners?
I'd like to share something with Eleanor, if I might.
Please.
When I was sick and when I got my transplant, people were always telling me that I was a hero. And I was never a hero. I would just lay there and receive the gift. Eleanor and all the donor families are the real heroes here, because if you think about it, it's their darkest moment, and at that moment, these families have the depth of love to reach out to other people and help them, even though they're experiencing the worst moment of their life. And I just don't know how you say thank you enough for that, but I do say thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm really honored to have met you virtually through Stuart, and I think the work you're doing is just wonderful.
Thank you. And actually, if you wanted to reach me at the same address I gave you, it would be at stiebe at transplant-speakers.
And Taibbi is spelled T as in Thomas, A-I-B-B-I. That's how people can reach him. People can also reach either one of you, actually, via my website, tellthetruthfaster.com, and there will be hyperlinks to both of your websites from my website from now on also, so that, you know, if people even who haven't been listening today get there and listen to the archive show, and they're moved to reach you, just so that you know that you may be getting emails from people a long time down the road from today's show.
That's terrific. The wonders of the web. I love it.
I know.
Thank you. Yeah, really. And I thank you, too, for helping with this cause. I mean, it just can't be helped enough.
Well,
so thank you, Stuart.
You're welcome. And it's really the purpose of this show is to bring humanity and human stories and put a face on the healing process. And that's what I do as a therapist, and that's my intention with the show. Now, I also want to thank both of you for being on the show today and taking your time and having just the compassion and the warmth of the way you share your stories and the way you reach out to help the community and, you know, our society. So thank you both.
You're so welcome.
You're welcome.
And also, called How to Find a Therapist, Finding and Choosing a Therapist. And my guest, Judy Gifford, had started this website called findatherapist.com, and she emailed me that within 10 minutes after the show, she had two emails of people who heard the show and sought out that website to find therapists. I'm hoping that as a result of this show, that some of you may get some emails and that maybe some organ donor organizations will find a flood of new donors, people deciding well in advance that this is something that's important to them and something they want to contribute to. So with that being said, I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Steve Taibbi and Eleanor Vincent for taking the time today to be on the show. Tune in again next Saturday from 1 to 2 p.m. on KXAM in Phoenix for Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. Thanks for listening.
That I heard of once in a while.
Thank you for listening to Independent 1310 KXAM, Mesa, Phoenix.